from the JAMA Network. This is the JAMA Pediatrics Editor's Summary, a discussion of the most important articles published in the latest issue of JAMA Pediatrics.
Hello again, podcast listeners. This is Dimitri Christakis, Editor-in-Chief of JAMA Pediatrics. We are back with our podcast after a brief hiatus, and we're new and improved. So those of you that listened before have heard that my prior co-host was Dr. Fred Rivara, my friend, colleague, and mentor, who has moved on to bigger and better things. And in his place is Dr. Allison Galbraith, who is an associate professor at the Department of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard Pilgrim Health Institute. I've known Allison for a long time, and I'm delighted to have her join us as a regular host. Welcome, Allie. Good to have you here.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So we have two papers to discuss today. The hosts have changed, but the format remains the same. Allie, you want to go first and tell us about the paper you picked?
Yeah, I have a great paper. It's called Receipt of EI, Early Intervention Services Before Age 3 and Performance on Third Grade Standardized Tests Among Lead-Exposed Children, by Jeanette Stignon and other colleagues from Columbia and the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. So they wanted to know whether participation in EI and early intervention improved test scores for kids with elevated lead. And, you know, so we know that elevated lead levels are associated with worse neurodevelopmental and school outcomes, even down at low levels like 2 micrograms a deciliter. And we know that EI helps improve academic outcomes for kids with developmental delays and other things like that. But we don't know if EI can help kids who have elevated lead levels who might be at risk for those sorts of things. So I don't know if listeners are as familiar with EI, but it's mandated under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act for kids under 3 who have developmental delays or disabilities. And some states allow eligibility based on lead levels, but they're usually pretty high, like over 10 to 15 micrograms per deciliter. And so this study was interested to know if kids who have lower, the more common, but lower lead levels could benefit. And like 5% of kids under 3 have lead levels that are above 3. So it affects a bunch of kids. So anyway, so they did a cohort study of children born in New York City who attended New York public schools and who had lead levels above 3 micrograms per deciliter. And New York State required lead testing for kids who were age 1 or 2. So kids all had lead testing. And they took advantage of this really unique administrative data set that linked data across a bunch of different departments in the state. So they had birth certificate data, lead surveillance data, early intervention enrollment and receipt of services data, and also school educational data. So they linked all that together. Their exposure of interest was any use of EI before age 3. And they had a lot of rich data from this data set to propensity match to make sure that the kids who did and did not get EI were as balanced as possible. And so then as outcomes, they looked at standardized math and English language arts scores from third grade. So they had like 2,800 kids who got EI matched to about 8,200 kids who didn't get EI, all of whom had elevated lead. And what they found was basically that EI was useful to these kids. So compared to kids who didn't get EI, the kids who got EI had better scores on the math and the English language test. So they did better by about 7% of a standard deviation, which is hard to sort of interpret. They did 7% better of a standard deviation on math and 14% of a standard deviation better on English. And that's basically what the authors explain is the equivalent of the gain you get from the beginning of third grade to the end of third grade. Or it's also equivalent to the gain you get from a smaller class size. So it's meaningful.
Yeah, that would be meaningful. That would definitely be the kinds of things we think about as being worth pursuing. Were these results surprising to you at all, Allison? So since we know EI works, or we like to believe it works, and we know that lead is bad, what was surprising to you about this, if anything?
Well, it wasn't surprising, actually. I mean, I think it makes sense, but I think it's nice to have a study like this that actually proves it to be able to say that we should change criteria, eligibility criteria for EI. And actually, it's interesting because, I mean, this was done on kids who were born, I think, in like the late 90s. And subsequently, some states have, in fact, New York State now has lowered the lead level to be eligible for EI. But I think that having these data, I think, make a compelling case that other states should make that change.
based on evidence of effectiveness. And for pediatricians there, how should this be affecting their daily practice? In some jurisdictions, we check lead levels frequently, others we don't at all.
That's how you get into EI, is you have to be referred by a pediatrician. So I think the pediatricians need to be aware that it matters for kids who have even these sort of a little bit elevated lead levels that they should be considering sending them to EI, depending on if their state has eligibility for that.
That's great. And I think contextualizing the findings the way you did for effect size is a great way of advocating for it, since it makes it something that everyone can understand as a meaningful difference.
You know, I just was impressed because this is a study that's both policy relevant, it can provide evidence to change policy, but it's also a really creative and well done study. Like, it's a great way to bring together a whole bunch of data, health data, educational data. So I really liked that.
Terrific. Our next paper is the association of COVID-19 vaccination during pregnancy with neonatal and early infant outcomes. So most of us, I think, are familiar by this point with both COVID and COVID vaccination. And most of us are also familiar with the fact that in early trials, pregnant women were intentionally excluded. And so there was very limited data on both the safety of vaccine, the efficacy of vaccination for mothers, and of course, for their newborns. There have been two prior studies that have looked at this, at the effects of immunization during pregnancy on newborns. And one of them, in fact, was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. But that study and the other one were both small and relied on self-report, which, of course, is prone to bias. This study used data from Israel and specifically data from Maccabi Healthcare Services, which is a large state-mandated health fund in Israel, which has over 2.5 million members, and over a quarter of the population belongs to it. So it's representative and large. And they were able to link maternal vaccination and infant outcomes through the use of this database. So they looked at a couple of things. They looked at, obviously, the whether or not mothers had been vaccinated. And then they had two primary a priori identified outcomes. The first were preterm birth and small for gestational age, two of the sort of most common adverse health outcomes that we think of that can be affected by pregnancy complications. And then they did a whole host of exploratory outcomes looking at hospitalizations for any cause in the first months of life, congenital malformations, and really any number of other ICD-9 codes that might differ by organ system. So sort of a what we call in health services research, kind of a fishing expedition, but appropriate as an exploratory analysis, since we really don't know what effects vaccination might have during pregnancy.
Wasn't that what people are worried about, congenital malformations or something, you know,
right,
from a vaccine?
Exactly. Well, as a pregnant mother, I think you're worried about any possible thing, right? Anything that could go wrong as a result of getting vaccinated. And I should say, the last time I was attending in the newborn nursery, there were quite a few mothers who were unvaccinated in this country, precisely because they were concerned about the untoward effects. In fact, many had been told by their OBs that it was unsafe to get vaccinated. But I'm getting ahead of myself because I haven't shared with you what the results of this study were. So it was large. It had included over 20,000 infants who had a total and matched those who had been vaccinated with those who had not been, and look to see what the effects were. And to sort of cut to the chase, it was a big, as we say, nothing burger. There were really no increased risk of small for gestational age, no increased risk of premature birth, and in the quote-unquote exploratory analyses, really no increased risk of any of those malformations. Although I should add that those are rare, and one could argue that they were relatively underpowered to see those, but they didn't see any difference between women who'd gotten the vaccine and those who had not in terms of adverse events in their children. And I think one of the reasons that this is important is that while we were uncertain of the risks posed to infants and fetuses from vaccination, we're well aware, including a study we published in JAMA Pediatrics, of the adverse effects of COVID in pregnant women. So we know that women who get COVID during pregnancy are at significantly increased risk of adverse events, both themselves and to their children. So I think this study really kind of provides important information and kind of balancing that risk posed to mothers and their babies really in favor of vaccinating women more widely.
I liked that they had a big sample and that they were able to answer some questions about some of these more rare outcomes. You know, it's hard to prove a negative, right? That there's not a problem. And some things like preterm birth and congenital anomalies and things like that are not that common. And they were able to do that with a big sample size to feel pretty good that they aren't really seeing an effect. One thing I thought was sort of interesting was that, if anything, some of the, like, for example, the findings about congenital anomalies lean toward protective. The vaccinated group had a lower rate of some stuff. So. I mean, it was not significant, but it was a little bit suggestive.
You're right. Although there were no significant findings, some of them actually trended towards vaccination. I guess there are two possible explanations for that, right? At least that I can think of. One is that the vaccine is, in fact, protective because it reduced the risk of exposure to the virus, which is more harmful than the vaccine is. And the second that one always worries about in these kinds of studies is sort of the residual confounding, like people who get vaccinated are fundamentally different than those who don't in ways that make them healthier to begin with. So again, for our listeners who are obstetricians, please vaccinate your pregnant mothers. And for our pediatricians who frequently see pregnant mothers in the context of other well child visits, please make a point of recommending that they get vaccinated. Any final thoughts, Ali? It's really great to have you here.
No, this is fun.
Look forward to having you as a regular commentator. And you can listen to this and previous episodes anywhere you get your podcast and at jamapediatrics.com. Thanks, Ali, as always, for joining me. And we will see you next month. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.